Thank you, Your Honor. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
3 minutes it is.
May it please the Court, my name is Lauren Woodley with the Richmond Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Eric Hamilton. Race discrimination in jury selection no longer involves systematic policies or practices effectuated broadly by prosecutor offices. It doesn't involve the so-called loaded question. But it is, after Batson and its progeny, subtle, it involves implicit bias, it involves safe words to hide discrimination, and it is still pervasive. This case demonstrates how subtle but present race discrimination is in jury selection in our trial systems in Virginia, specifically when it comes to the disparate treatment of white and black jurors. What we have here, alone with the strike of Juror Cooper, is a requirement that this court reverse Mr. Hamilton's conviction and remand this case for a new trial. Juror Cooper alone, because of the disparate treatment of him versus two similarly situated white jurors, requires this reversal. The Supreme Court in Foster against Chapman said that the Constitution forbids striking even a single prospective juror for a discriminatory purpose. Here, the race-neutral reason that was offered by the prosecutor, and I quote, for Juror Cooper was, he did not answer any of the questions. I really didn't have much information on him. Yet, there were two white jurors, Juror Orland and Juror Jordan, who also did not answer any questions and were quiet. Yet, the prosecutor did not strike those jurors. And the prosecutor did not explain and was not required to explain by the trial judge this disparate treatment. And that is essentially the crux of the error here in this third prong of Batson. That's what shows that the reason was pretextual. This court is bound by two published opinions that we do talk about in our brief that I think control the outcome here. Those are Brody and Hopkins. In Brody, this court reversed a conviction where the prosecutor struck young black men from the jury, proffered that the reason or the race-neutral reason for striking those individuals was because their age was similar to the defendants, yet similarly aged white men remained on the jury panel. This court said that after the Commonwealth has asserted a facially race-neutral reason to strike, but has struck jurors of one race, and the reason asserted for the strike is equally applicable to other members of the veneer of a different race, the reason asserted is not a satisfactory race-neutral explanation for the Commonwealth strikes. In Hopkins, again, we had a similar situation where this court reversed a conviction. The prosecutor had struck black jurors with family members charged with drug crimes, but white jurors who also had family members charged with drug crimes remained on the jury. And this court specifically noted that the lack of explanation or the trial court's requirement that there be an explanation from the prosecutor about this disparate treatment was the error. And that's really what we have here with Juror Cooper. And not only do we challenge and did we challenge in the trial court Juror Cooper strikes, there were two other strikes, Juror Taylor Walker and Juror Green, that show that this was discriminatory peremptory strikes by the prosecution. In Juror Taylor Walker and Juror Green's case, the one proffered race-neutral reason they shared was that they were unemployed. But the prosecutor never connected their unemployment to the case at hand. He didn't say why that he was striking those jurors because unemployment was a factor that might affect their bias or their outlook on the case.
But can I ask you on that, Ms. Whitley? I mean, do we have any case law that says if you are going to say you're going to strike someone because you're unemployed, you have to connect it to that case? Because don't we even have cases that say, while you absolutely may not, based under Batson and its progeny, make any decision based on race or gender, that if you look at someone and say, I don't like the way you do your hair, you can strike them? Or it can be just almost ridiculous, but it's upheld.
It has to be, though, Your Honor, a reason that is not shown to be pretextual. And I think with the unemployment, there's kind of two things going on there. One is the prosecutor himself, when asked about Juror Green, who one of the reasons that he proffered he struck him was because he didn't have the information about his employment in the past, even acknowledged that he could have asked him questions about that, but did not. So the prosecutor, on the kind of the flip side, can't stick their head in the sand and not ask questions to then be able to use that answer as a reason for striking someone who they are trying to strike based on their race. Secondly, I'd point out that this court hasn't specifically found kind of the positive version or the yin to the yang that this is unemployment must be connected to the case for the proffered reason, but has done the reverse, has said that when a prosecutor proffers that he was looking for educated jurors, he was concerned that this juror hadn't attended college, that that was important because it was a complicated case. I believe that was a financial crimes case, and the name's escaping me, but it's cited in our brief. And in that case, this court upheld the strike by saying, okay, they had connected the proffered reason to the facts of the case, and so the reverse has to be true. When they make a proffer that is generic, where they don't ask any follow-up questions, and there's no explanation for why that specific fact or was significant to the case at hand or their selection of juries or the bias of the jurors, that's certainly something this court can consider in determining if the proffered reason was pretextual. Because that's essentially the stage that we're at, and that we're asking this court to review.
And what deference do we owe the trial court in its finding that it was not pretextual?
It's a factual finding. It's deference to the trial court's determination. And this court has made clear that the trial court views the jurors and you know, kind of observes their demeanor.
And views the prosecutor as well and his or her explanation of the purpose of the strike.
That's true, although here there's no real factual findings that the trial court articulates on the record to support the race-neutral reasons. He doesn't say, I believe there's a generic statement about I observed the jurors, I saw juror Taylor Walker in particular when she answered the questions about the crime charge.
Well, the judge does say independently evaluated the proffered reasons and evaluated the prosecutor.
But this court... Your Honor, I'm sorry, I must have missed that second part. I didn't recollect that he said he evaluated the prosecutor. I remember him saying questions about evaluating the jurors, so I apologize if he did say that. But
he would any disputed facts. Okay.
So I think even still, this court does have an obligation to review the trial court's determination. So that deference, while it exists, is not complete, right? So here, because there are, particularly, again, just kind of looping back to Juror Cooper, because we do have clear evidence of different treatment of a black and white juror, and the trial court never investigated that or asked the prosecutor to explain that, that in and of itself is problematic. So even if this court gives the due deference to the factual findings about the demeanor by not asking the prosecutor to explain it, when it was brought to the trial court's attention, that error, we believe, is fatal and requires a reversal. And even so, the lack of kind of factual findings here about the demeanor of the jurors, this court in other cases, in Hopkins, for example, the published case previously mentioned, I believe there was a generic statement by Mr. Hopkins' counsel about the juror, the veneer, not being a jury of its peers, and this court went back and looked to the entire record to see if it supported the race-neutral reason that was given. And I think that is something this court, the analysis this court is obliged to engage in here.
Does the record support you... My question is on the unemployment. Does the record support that there are white jurors who were unemployed?
I don't think that there was a specific highlight or mention on the record about other white jurors.
I didn't think there was either. But
I think that one is more, and that is a little, because there are a couple of race-neutral reasons. Yeah. That's less about disparate treatment and more about just it being one of those kind of safe words to use, you know, that can cover racial discrimination in the jury selection process.
So the veneer here had... 5 of the 15 members were African-American,
that's
right?
That's correct.
And then the actual jury, since it's a misdemeanor, being it was seven-member jury, 2 of the 7 were African-American. So it's approximately the same percentage, you know, around 25 to 33%, something like that.
Right. I don't think that proportionality is the appropriate analysis, Your Honor. It's not about whether or not a black juror or a person of color was on the jury panel. It is about was any particular juror struck because of their race. That is it, kind of in the analysis there. So even if the jury had ended up being entirely black, I would argue that if any member was struck because of their race, that requires reversal. And I think that the case law fairly supports that. There is a published case from this court, Jackson against Commonwealth, that does speak a little bit to the proportionality analysis and how that isn't really an appropriate framework to view the Batson challenge and determining if a prosecutor's proffered reasons were, in fact, race neutral. And I would point the court to that case. I'm happy to answer any other questions. I think Juror Taylor Walker, the additional challenge we had for her was that she was similarly situated to another white juror as well with the crime charged analysis.
The one you claimed she was similarly situated to was the claim team leader for an insurance company?
Juror Sanderson.
How do you say that somebody is similarly situated to someone who did investigative work for an insurance company?
Well, because of that particular race-neutral reason that was proffered, Your Honor. And I think that's what we're talking about when we're talking about similarly situated. The prosecutor, so, you know, it's that tennis game. The prima facie case is made. The prosecutor has to offer those race-neutral reasons. For Juror Taylor Walker, the prosecutor made clear that he struck her for two race-neutral, proffered race-neutral reasons. She was charged with a crime, and she was unemployed.
But the prosecutor would much rather have an insurance investigator than it would somebody that had been previously charged with a crime, wouldn't they? Regardless of what race they are?
That may be true, Your Honor, but...
Because the defense struck the insurance investigator, correct?
As the final strike, I would point out.
First or the final, they struck them, correct?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I don't think, again, that affects the analysis of this court, whether or not the defendant struck it or not. It is essentially whether or not it was similarly situated. But to go back to the court's question...
You also don't know whether that insurance investigator had been charged with a crime, had been the victim of a crime, or had a family member that was involved in a criminal offense somehow.
That's exactly right.
And the prosecutor didn't have any duty to ask that question.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think if they're going to use that reason as a race-neutral reason, they cannot, again, hide and not ask questions to clarify that ambiguity.
But how is that hiding when you choose not to ask somebody else which of the three they've been a part of? When you choose to strike somebody because they've been charged with a crime previously?
Because they are making the proffer of the race-neutral reason, Your Honor. So I would point the court to Miller L. versus Drake. In that case, the Supreme Court reversed a capital conviction in part because a black juror was struck due to his ambiguity about the death penalty. And the Supreme Court specifically noted that the prosecutor chose not to pursue that line of questioning.
And but so that's apples and oranges compared to somebody, the juror that's been charged with a criminal offense sitting on a criminal trial.
I guess I disagree, Your Honor. I see it as the flip side of the analysis. In this situation here, the prosecutor can't choose not to ask additional questions of a white juror, hoping they remain on the jury and are not similarly situated to or are similarly.
But if they thought that somebody had been charged with a crime, they wouldn't want them remaining on the jury, in all likelihood.
Or, Your Honor, it's an example of implicit bias. And the prosecutor in this particular situation, because this juror was white, made assumptions about whether or not that juror was charged with a crime.
So somehow they preferred a white criminal over a black criminal? Is that...
Well, Your Honor, this is the argument that we make when we're talking about racial discrimination. It is not something that it will be as obvious as it was during the Batson days with the systemic racism. But if I could, Judge Atlee, go back to your initial question about the insurance, her job being in insurance, this court cannot come up with reasons to support the prosecutor's
proffer. But the trial court already did.
There's nothing on the record where the trial court said because she's an insurance agent.
The trial court
agent.
Wasn't required to explain that. Inherent in the trial court's ruling was a credibility determination that whether they're persuasive or not, the prosecutor satisfactorily provided race-neutral reasons.
Right. And Your Honor, our challenge is that because there were jurors who were similarly situated as well as the lack of explanation connecting the two, that finding was wrong. And this court cannot go back and try to come up with
but
reasons.
But how in the light in the most favorable to the Commonwealth do you determine that those two were similarly situated?
Well, Your Honor, essentially our argument, and again, this is why I started with it, Juror Cooper does. I mean, Juror Cooper is clear on the
record. We're talking about Taylor Walker.
I understand. But Juror Taylor Walker, the argument here is that the prosecutor did not and chose not to ask a clarifying question about whether Juror Sanderson, was charged with a crime, the victim of a crime, or witness to a crime. And then the prosecutor specifically highlighted with Juror Taylor Walker that he was striking her in part as a race-neutral reason because she was charged with a crime. Yet the prosecutor never engaged in that conversation to clarify with a white juror, Juror Sanderson, whether she was charged with a crime or the victim or a witness. The prosecutor refuse to ask questions or not clarify ambiguities and then use those to provide the race-neutral reason. We're arguing that shows that there was pretext here as to why these three black jurors were struck. Out of the four jurors that were struck by the prosecution. So that's our argument with Juror Taylor Walker, as far as the similarly situated. I'm very much into my rebuttal, but I'm happy to answer any questions about our two remaining assignments of error, or I can save that for rebuttal.
Mr. Jones, good morning.
Good morning.
15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And good morning. May it please the Court. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we're asking the Court to affirm Mr. Hamilton's conviction because he has failed to show any reversible error on any of his assignments of error. So on the Batson issue, I want to point out at the outset, something that came up in the reply brief was an allegation that 5A18 doesn't really apply to Batson Step 3. So I did a little bit of research on that and came up with the case Buck versus Commonwealth. It went through at the Supreme Court. It was 247 Virginia 449. And the court there did find that arguments on Batson Prong 3 were precluded. They weren't preserved under Rule 525 because they were not presented to the trial court. And so the idea that the trial court doesn't have to be given the opportunity to pass on specific arguments about why proffered reasons from the prosecution are or are not pretextual is meritless. The Supreme Court in Buck found that that the trial court does have to have an opportunity to evaluate those for them to be preserved for appellate review. And, you know, in that case, if you look at it, you have a very similar factual situation where the Batson motion was made, the prosecutor offered their race-neutral reasons for the strikes, and then there was a brief objection to those reasons given by the defense, and then it got a whole lot better on appeal. And actually, the Court of Appeals in its panel decision reversed and remanded and said that the Batson motion should have been granted. But then en banc, that got turned back around, and it came up to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and they settled the issue that those particular arguments were not preserved.
The newer U.S. Supreme Court cases undercut the Buck decision?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but standing here before you, I can't say with certainty that I've really considered Buck in that light. I do know when I shepherdize it, it doesn't come up with any red flags, but I'd be happy to submit supplemental briefing to the court if it would like a deeper look into that issue.
Thank you, counsel.
So, but given that 5A18 does apply to this Batson Step 3 sort of argument, depending on how you cut it, Hamilton makes five or six arguments on Batson on appeal, and only one or two of those was presented to the trial court. So his arguments about whether Sanderson and Taylor Walker's previous involvement in the criminal justice system was similarly situated and disparate treatment is not preserved. The argument about the failure to question Sanderson and Taylor Walker in the same manner is also not preserved. The argument about the
whose burden is it?
The burden of persuasion rests with the opponent of the strikes throughout the process, even once a prima facie showing has been made and the burden shifts back to the prosecution to provide race-neutral explanations. And that my authority for that is Lightfoot versus Commonwealth makes it very clear and cites to Supreme Court of the United States authority for the proposition that the burden of persuasion overall never departs from the opponent of the strikes. And that really goes along well with the deference that's given to the trial court's determination on whether to accept or reject the prosecutor's race-neutral explanations, and then whether or not to accept or reject the objection to those race-neutral explanations. And so the failure to question Green and Cooper more fully and the sort of analogy to an ostrich this race, it wasn't raised to the trial court. And then the connectedness of the reasons to the case and the discussion of Miller-El was not raised to the trial court. So all of those are barred by 518.
Can you talk to us about Tyrone Cooper?
Tyrone Cooper. The biggest argument on him that I see that Hamilton raises is about his silence in his failure to respond. And my best answer to you on that is that the trial court was there to see not only the individualized questioning that's reflected in the transcript before this court, but also the group answers and sort of the demeanor of the different veneer members. And so when the Commonwealth said that he was not responsive and they just didn't have a lot of information on him, The trial court was in the best position to evaluate whether that was true, not only on...
How do you respond to Ms. Whitley's argument that the same reason essentially was given, the same observation was made of two white members of the veneer?
Two white members of the veneer, and then I think also two black members of the veneer that wound up serving on the jury. I would respond that the trial court was in the best position to, and the record does not establish that they were silent during the group questioning. There's just a lack of individualized questioning on them. So I think that this goes under the trial court's very great discretion in determining the validity of these factual questions.
Mr. Jones, to your point about who's in the best position to look at these things, aren't there different ways of conveying silence? And essentially, there's the eye contact that looks like someone's attentive versus slumped over and looking at the shoes where somebody appears to be inattentive. And that's something that we as an appellate court can't pick up off of a cold record.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's one of the reasons I cited to one of the living record cases, Dalton versus Commonwealth, for the proposition that the living record, what the trial court is actually looking at as it's ruling on these motions, contains many guideposts to the truth that aren't in the cold record before this court. And I think, to your Honor's point, there are a lot of ways to be silent, and some of them are more attentive than others. And body language can convey a lot that will never show up on a transcript. Perhaps if this objection had been more fully developed and we had more of a record about what the trial court was and wasn't looking at. But the fact of the matter is that precise argument was not made to the trial court. They said that these four jurors were quiet, but we don't have any more information as to... as to how deep that went.
Is your position that if the prosecutor gives a facially race-neutral reason, it then becomes the defendant's burden to show that that's a pretext for the purposes of the trial court's factual finding?
If the trial court accepts the race-neutral justification, then yes, I think that the burden of persuasion is on the burden shifts at that point to the opponent of the strike to show that the reason was pretextual.
And what case supports that?
I would point the court to Lightfoot for the general proposition. And I think Batson it lays out this three-part analysis that first you've got the strike, and if it is a prima facie case, then the prosecutor needs to explain why it's not impermissible discrimination. And then at that point, the defendant has an opportunity to demonstrate that those were in fact pretextual. But I just think that inherently and analytically it has to. Otherwise, I can't imagine why there's a third step.
So back to Judge Beal's hypothetical to Ms. Whitley. I strike that juror because I don't like the way her hair looks. Then it's up to the defendant to say, well, Your Honor, that's obviously a pretext because this other juror's hair is the same way and this other juror's hair is the same way, and then the judge makes the determination?
I think that in that instance, if the record demonstrated that jurors 1, 2, and 3 had the same hair and only juror 1 was struck and jurors 2 and 3 were of a different race, I think that maybe in that instance you could reverse the trial court.
But I guess my question is, once the prosecutor gives the facially race-neutral reason, your point is then it's the defendant's burden to refute that for the purpose of the trial court's the third step.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, I think that otherwise there wouldn't be a third step if the trial court rejected.
Well, the trial court would have to make a finding. That's the third step.
Yes. Okay. That's not the way that I had pictured it.
Okay.
I think that. Yeah, I think that if the trial court accepts, or if the trial court rejects the race-neutral explanation, you never get to the third step.
Correct.
But if the trial court accepts that, then that's when the defendant has an opportunity to say, hey, look, here's a really good example of why this is a pretext. And then the trial court either accepts that or rejects that. And if they accept it, then that is due deference, I think.
Right. I think you and I were saying the same.
Okay.
And your argument is that was not done here from Mr. Cooper?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or even with regard to Are you also making that argument with regard to
Green?
Taylor Walker and Green.
Taylor Walker. Well, with regard to Taylor Walker, I don't think that any of these arguments going deeper into the dichotomy between Taylor Walker and Sanderson were presented to the trial court. But to the extent that we reached the merits of that, yes, I think that the trial court was in the best position to evaluate the responses. And Lightfoot makes a point, I think, that these are largely credibility determinations about whether to accept or reject the proffered race-neutral reasons and whether they may be pretextual. And then also, yes, Your Honor, with Cooper and with Green, those reasons that were proffered. As far as the silence goes, I think that is just down to the court's discretion and whether to accept or reject the defendant's argument about whether it was pretextual. On the employment thing, I don't think that there's even been a threshold showing that there was anything that anybody else had any particular employment status. I don't think that the trial courts or that the prosecutors, the only ground that they challenged the prosecutor's employment comment on was that racism was unemployed was a code word for black. And
that point was made.
But I don't know that that's been carried forward here, but to the extent that it was, I think that you have to defer to the trial.
There was nothing provided to support that proposition. Nothing, no statistics provided to the trial court or any kind of evidence that that's a code word for.
No, Your Honor, that was just a plain language argument and sort of a broad reference to cases have said, but never really said what cases. But again, I don't think that was really developed on appeal here. I don't think that's been carried forward, but to the extent that it might have been, I don't think that that Hamilton's able to overcome the presumption that this judgment has come to this court with, that the trial court correctly applied the facts of the law and that its credibility determination was valid. Really quickly,
can I ask you on the third assignment of error?
Yes, Your Honor.
Given that the indictment was under subpart A of the statute, and the jury instruction, which both sides agreed to, was on subpart B, is that a problem for the Commonwealth on appeal?
On appeal, I don't believe so, Your Honor. Because I do not believe that Hamilton can show an entitlement to into justice review here. I don't think that there's
Does it become law of the case?
It does become law of the
Bryant
case.
Under Bryant and other cases?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why I only briefed subpart B in the sufficiency analysis, was because that agreed upon instructions become law of the case. So to the extent that there's a possibility that they went back in the jury room and got confused about whether they should be reading the indictment or the instructions, I think that was, number one, that was cleared up by the instructions that their verdict had to be unanimous, and that here are the elements of the case, and this is what you have to find him guilty. But even if you take the unlikely proposition that they could have gotten tripped up and that some of them might have been reading the elements of A and some of them might have been reading the elements of B, the most that can show is a possibility of
prejudice. They never had the elements of A, other than the indictment.
Other than in the indictment, that's correct, Your Honor. So to the extent that that was even a possibility, though, the most that could show is a possibility of prejudice, and that's not enough to satisfy the second prong of the ends of justice threshold question.
I guess if we did get past the ends of justice and reach the merits, A is broader than B, isn't it?
I think that under A, you have to show an actual that the investigation was actually impeded, whereas under B, an attempt, a use of force or threat to attempt to impede is sufficient. I don't know where that leaves us on that question, but, Your Honor, I don't think that the court needs to, again, reach that, because I don't think ends of justice is appropriate in this. So I see that my time is expiring, unless any other questions, I'd just ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Ms. Whitley, we're going to go ahead and give you a whopping 2 minutes.
I appreciate it, Your Honor.
give Mr. Blosser a minute to get the clock right.
Two total additional minutes.
Just two total, yes.
All right. I just wanted to highlight that the Commonwealth seems to be asserting at this stage that at trial, Mr. Hamilton did not challenge the race-neutral reason for Juror Cooper. He absolutely did. It's on page 56 of the Joint Appendix. Trial counsel actually made very clear that, and she cites Jurors Orland and Jordan, that they were quiet and similarly situated. And I believe she uses a didn't answer many questions, but essentially bringing to the trial court's attention that the race-neutral reason...
Didn't answer many questions?
That was her proffer. And I think that's specific enough, Your Honor. I think we're saying to the trial court at that point that, you know, look, that reason is a pretext. And I would point the court specifically to Brody.
Well, I've got to ask you about that, though, Ms. Whitley. He said, Mr. Cooper, I'm reading from what you told me to look at. Mr.
Yes,
Cooper's
Your Honor.
Concerned there are other individuals in the panel who also didn't speak. So
right.
You're saying Mr. Cooper didn't speak. Mr. Moss didn't speak very much.
Right.
Ms. Jordan in the front row didn't say many things. Isn't that different?
I would argue it's not, because at that stage we're talking about whether or not Mr. Hamilton has raised the trial court's attention that there are similarly situated jurors.
So saying nothing right. is the same as saying not much?
I would argue that they, because what we're asking is the broader question of, has the trial counsel brought to the trial court's attention that there are challenges here to the race-neutral reason, that this might be a pretext?
So there's a challenge, but it's different language.
I don't think that makes or breaks the challenge, Your Honor, because at that stage, I would argue, and Brody makes this very clear from this court, a published opinion, the trial court was then obliged to inquire into the prosecutor's proffered reason, because the defendant had made clear, Mr. Hamilton had made clear, that he did not believe that the race-neutral reason was, in fact, race-neutral. And in Brody, this court actually states that the record does not show satisfactory race-neutral reasons for the strikes. If such existed, we hold the Commonwealth should have been required to explain its reasons for striking black jurors and not white jurors of the same age in order to overcome the presumption that the strikes were racially motivated. So with Juror Cooper, that's the challenge here. I don't think there are magic words that it has to be exact by trial counsel. She put the trial court on notice that there were other jurors on the panel who were similarly situated, and there was a requirement that they investigate. I think that's
Thank you, Ms. Whitley.
Thank you.
We're going to come down and greet counsel, and then we're going to take a short